The term marginalized is not a new word. It can be found as far back as the 1870s, but it's a word we hear a lot of today, and it's taken on a renewed meaning. Literally, the word marginalized means to treat a person or a group of people as insignificant, as peripheral. We usually hear about it today with regard to people or groups of people who are shunned, who are isolated because of their ethnicity or their gender or perhaps their lifestyle. Here in John chapter 4, we meet an individual who was marginalized, who was isolated by her community for all three of those reasons. John introduces the scene in John chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. The Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, being John the Baptist. Although, in fact, it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. I want to stop right there. Those of you that may be familiar with the geography of the New Testament know that Galilee, Samaria, and Judea were in a straight line, north to south. If there had been a highway back then, it would have just gone straight through. If you had put Jerusalem to Galilee on your GPS back then and had it take you the most direct route, it would have told you to go straight north, right through Samaria. So it would only make sense to us that you would go through Samaria to get to Galilee. But in those days, it wasn't done. Good, outstanding Jews would go all the way out and around Samaria. They would cross the Jordan River, go miles out of their way not to go through Samaria. Because, as we're going to see, they didn't want anything to do with the Samaritans. They didn't even want to walk on their ground. They were certainly the marginalized people of that day. They were isolated from the Jewish people. This goes back to their history. Back in the Old Testament, those of you may be familiar with the story of how the nation of Israel divided, much like our country divided back in the 1860s. There was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And in this case, the southern kingdom, called Judah, retained the national capital of Jerusalem. The northern kingdom, which retained the name Israel, had to build their own. And so they built a city called Samaria. And that's where the capital of the northern kingdom was. Now, in time, the northern kingdom was defeated by the Assyrian Empire. And the Assyrians, as was their practice, would take people from other defeated lands and transplant them into this defeated land. So while there were some Israelites left, there were also foreigners brought in and made to live among them. And in time, they began intermarrying with them. And what arose was this nation of half Israelite, half Gentile, what the Jews would call half-breeds, that had their own culture and their own religion, their own way of life, to the point that the Jews didn't want anything to do with them. So, for John to write, it was necessary for Jesus to go through Samaria. He wasn't speaking geographically. He was speaking spiritually. He had a mission. He had an appointment to keep in Samaria. And in verses 5 and 6, we see the rest of the background. He came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. As Bob explained to us, this would be about noon, the heat of the day. Jesus and the disciples had walked a long way. He was tired. He sent the disciples into town to get food, and he was staying there at the well. And it was at this point that we're introduced to the individual Jesus would encounter. A woman from the town of Samaria whose life was about to be changed forever. Now, I don't want to focus all of our attention this morning in the details of the passage. Really, what I want to see here is some lessons we can learn from how Jesus interacted with her. Lessons that we can then apply in our lives as we interact with individuals who don't know Jesus. Particularly those who have been isolated. Those who are shunned by their community. Or, more significantly, shunned by the church. People that good Christians shouldn't be seen with. Jesus gives us some very clear and applicable lessons that we can learn. The first one is that Jesus started a conversation. Look at verses 7 through 9. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" John adds here, "For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Literally, the Greek says, "Jews don't use dishes that Samaritans use." So when Jesus asked for a drink, he was going to be using the scoop out of the Samaritan woman's hand. And that just wasn't done. In fact, this conversation should never have happened on a number of levels back in those days. At that time, men and women rarely conversed publicly. Husbands didn't even talk to their wives in public. That was saved for their homes. But not only was this person a woman, she was one almost everyone would have overlooked. She had a past. She had a reputation. And to be seen with her might damage your own reputation. And then she was a Samaritan. I'm sure Jesus was taught from his early days, you don't have anything to do with Samaritans. You don't talk to them. You avoid them as much as possible. We would say today that she was marginalized due to her ethnicity, her gender, and her lifestyle. Three strikes. She's out. And that's the way most people looked at her. She knew that. That's why she would come at the heat of the day by herself instead of joining the other women of the village that would go out in the morning or the evening to draw water. But I want you to notice that Jesus did not give up his ethnic or cultural identity to minister to someone of a different race and a different culture. His willingness to engage her socially by drinking water from a cup opened the door for him to reach her spiritually. And we should never ignore or reject the humanity of people that are different than us as we share with them the good news of the gospel. This is very much a break from the status quo. We would say this was very politically incorrect for Jesus to do, much like my tie this morning. Politically incorrect. Not a bad thing sometimes. And Jesus was not afraid to break those social mores, so to speak. He never acted immorally. He never broke God's law. He did not compromise his morality, but he was not afraid to go against what people thought was proper. And what people would have said in those days was, "You don't talk to her. She's a woman. She's a Samaritan. And she's immoral. You're a man, a Jew, and you're the Holy Son of God. You couldn't be any more different." But Jesus began a conversation. And the lesson for us is very clear. We need to have contact with non-Christians. But by and large, we ignore that lesson. Studies have shown that when a person comes to Christ, and we're talking here about an adult who comes to Jesus Christ, they're good for non-Christian contacts for about 2 years. For 2 years, they still have the guys that they ran around with or the ladies that they, you know, were socially involved with, people in their neighborhood, their families, their work, friends. But within 2 years, most Christians are so insulated within the church, they don't know anybody personally that doesn't know Jesus. We're so busy coming to church and Bible study and prayer meeting and this, that, and the other thing and fellowships, as long as it's within the church, we have nothing to do with people of the outside world. Do you know what the Bible calls that? Salt that's lost its savor. And it's not good for much of anything. We wonder why our churches don't grow. We wonder why we don't see more baptisms. We don't see more people coming to Christ. And quite honestly, the reason why is we're out of touch. Who do you know right now? Whose names could you put on a piece of paper that you have a decent relationship with that does not know Jesus Christ as their Savior and Lord? For some of us, it would be really hard to come up with more than one or two. We've lost touch. We're the ones doing the isolating. We isolate others, and in doing so, we isolate ourselves. Jesus reached out to this person that other people wouldn't speak to. I like how one author put it. The Holy Spirit can't save saints or seats. And that's true. But in most of our dealings, we're only dealing with people that have our same beliefs. Because we're afraid. We're afraid of what other people might think. I think we're afraid that they might rub off on us. I remember when I was in first and second grade, boys did not hang around girls. Ew. They've got cooties. Blech. And they were really contagious. You just didn't go around them. You didn't talk to them. Heaven forbid you ever touch one. Oh, ugh. Yuck. Okay, we got over that eventually. But I wonder how many of us Christians have the same attitudes towards people out in the world. People who don't think like us. People who don't vote like us. People who don't act like us, talk like us. Keep them away. What are we afraid of? We really think we're going to catch something from them? We claim to have the cure. What are we afraid of? Now I want you to notice how Jesus started this conversation. He started it with a question. Questions are great ways to start conversations. They put people at ease. They let that person know that you're really interested about them. You care about what they think. You care about who they are. Jesus was known for asking questions. The Gospels record over 300 questions that Jesus asked. Almost double the number of questions that people asked him. He asked a very simple question. And we can start very superficially. You can talk about the weather. You can talk about the Illini. You can talk about the economy. But talk about something that maybe you're both interested in, or something that is a common interest, as we're going to see in our next point. Jesus sought a commonality. These two individuals couldn't have been any more different, and yet Jesus knew we're both at a well, we're both getting water. Can you give me a drink? very simple, very unpretentious, and it opened the door for the conversation to continue. So Jesus sought a common interest, a commonality. And she responds, "What do you have to draw with? I mean, you don't even have a bucket. How are you going to get water?" And he says, "Well, if you knew who was talking to you, you'd be asking me for living water. Springs of water that come up, you don't have to have a bucket to draw out of. It's just there." Ooh, that sounds pretty good. You know, it's kind of a drag coming out here at the heat of the day and hauling all that water. I'd love to have some living water that I wouldn't have to come into this well and draw from all the time. Jesus very subtly, very naturally allowed the conversation to progress along a common denominator. He didn't dump everything on her at once. We know how this conversation ends. Could you imagine if when the woman comes up, Jesus says, "Hi, I'm Jesus, I'm the Messiah." She'd have been gone. She wouldn't have listened to a word he had to say. But he starts off simple. Simple conversation, finds a common element that they're both interested in, and only gives her enough of the truth that she can handle at the time to allow the conversation to continue. Now, the next part of this conversation is really shocking. If I had been writing this script, this would not have happened. Verse 16, he told her, "Go call your husband and come back." You're like, "No, Jesus, you didn't go there." Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's got this woman and she's showing some interest and you know, he broke the ice and she's warming up to him a little bit, curious about what he's offering, and then he drops a bombshell. "Go call your husband." And she says, "Well, I don't have a husband." He knew that. In fact, he said, "You're right. You don't have a husband. You had five, and the guy you're with now, you're not married to." What Jesus did here was he solidified his credibility. And he did it in two ways. The first one is obvious. He told her something that he should not have known about her. I'm sure the first thing that flashed through her mind was, "Who told him?" I remember my freshman year in Bible college, Bob had just graduated the year before. He had been there prior to me, and he was still working on campus at the time. And my birthday came real early in the school year. And I was in a class, it was a history class, one of Bob's favorite professors, and Bob let him know that it was my birthday that day. So we're in a class of about 40 students. And at the beginning of the class, the professor says, "I understand that it's somebody's birthday today," and he looks right at me, and a girl from over here says, "Who told him?" Oops. Let that cat out of the bag. I'm thinking that's what this Samaritan woman is thinking too. Who told this guy? And the obvious answer was, no one could have. Because this guy's a Jew. He doesn't talk to Samaritans. Samaritans don't talk to him. So there's only one other way that he could have known this. He must be something special. He's not an ordinary man. And in what she says following, you understand that she gets it. "I perceive you're a prophet." See, back then, prophets not only spoke on behalf of God, but they also had special insights into people. Remember the story where the woman's anointing Jesus' feet and wiping his feet with her hair, and the guy says, "If this was really a prophet, he'd know the kind of woman she was." That was an expectation of a prophet back then. And she recognized that here is somebody that's not your typical ordinary person. He knows something about me that there's no way he could know unless God told him. But there's a second way in which Jesus solidified his credibility that I think is more applicable for us, because we're not going to be given those insights. We're not normally going to walk up to somebody we've never met and God just kind of downloads their whole life story into our brain. That's not going to happen. This is one of those places where Jesus is the Son of God and you're not, so we're not going to be able to do exactly like this. Besides that, I'm not sure I would necessarily go quite this bold. But here's the other way he solidified his credibility. He did not judge her. Yes. He pointed out the fact that she had had five husbands and the guy she's with now, she's not married to, but at no point do you see condemnation. In fact, you see just the opposite. Not that he condones what she's doing, but he says, you are right in saying you have no husband. He gives her credit for at least telling the truth there. Now, he could have just slammed her with the truth of her sin. Instead, he congratulates her on telling a truth, even though it's only half of one. And what he does here is he can separate the sin from the sinner. You know, we talk about that a lot. Hate the sin, love the sinner. And that's not easy to do. And we generally don't do a very good job of it. We tend to hate one and hate the other too. Here Jesus is able to point out sin without condemning her. Just like the woman that had been caught in adultery. Remember her? John 8? We're going to see her in several weeks from now. Neither do I condemn you, he said. But then he added, go and sin no more. He's not condoning the lifestyle, but he is loving her, receiving her, talking to her, building that bridge of trust and credibility so that he can bring to her the ultimate truth. Most of us, though, are quick to condemn. We have this mistaken idea that if I don't condemn that sin, they're going to think I'm condoning it. Well, Jesus didn't feel that way. He didn't sugarcoat the sin. Actually, what he did was he allowed the sin to work on her own conscience. He didn't have to condemn her. Most of the people you run into, they know they're guilty. They know they're wrong. They don't need you judging them. They're judging themselves. What they need is a way out. And that's what Jesus provides. And when God puts someone in our lives, there's going to be things that separate us. The differences. And we can focus on the differences or we can focus on what brings us together. We can allow our differences to make us look down on the other person. I would never live like that. I would never dress that way. I would never listen to that kind of music. Jesus never did that. Romans 15:7 tells us, accept one another just as Jesus accepted you. That's a pretty high standard. Because Jesus accepted us as we were. We're not called to judge. That's God's job. We don't have to be the accuser. There's already one of those, and his name is Satan. By the way, Satan's name literally means accuser. That's what he's good at. So we don't need to be the prosecutor or the judge. We need to be a witness that's telling them the truth. Now you might wonder, why would Jesus bring up her sin at all? I mean, why did he even have to mention this? Jesus came to give this woman a new life. But in order to get a new life, you've got to get rid of your old life. A sick soul cannot be healed without getting to the root of the problem. And she had to be willing to turn away that idea of repentance, a change of heart and mind that leads to a change of action. She had to be willing to go there before she could receive the gift he was offering. And at some point in our conversation with people, we are going to have to bring up the problem of sin. Because if there is no sin, there is no need. But we have to do it in such a way that we're not judging them as though we're superior. We come to them as a fellow sinner that's just as much in need of forgiveness as they are. Why did he have to bring up this sin? Well, I think this was the one thing that in her mind, and probably in the minds of a lot of those who knew her, identified her. And this is very relevant in our day and age. There was a time when people would say, "Don't label me because of how I live. I'm more than my addiction or my lifestyle or whatever." Now people are embracing it and saying, "This is my identity." And we've got to be able to show people that no, your identity is not what you've done or what you are doing. Your identity is that you are a person created in the image of God and a soul for whom Christ died. That's your identity. That's who you are. No matter what you've done, no matter how you live, that's who you are. And that's what Jesus did for this marginalized woman, rejected because of her ethnic background, because of her gender, because of her lifestyle. Nobody wanted anything to do with her. She was a thing. She was that immoral woman. And you can put all of the nasty slang terms that they probably called her in that place. Ceases to be human. Jesus did not condemn her. He allowed her sin to condemn itself. Well, Jesus sidestepped a controversy next. In verse 19, the woman says, "Sir, I can see that you are a prophet." One of those understatement of the week. "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place we must worship is in Jerusalem." What does the woman do here? Tries to totally get the conversation off the rails. It's always easier to talk about theology than to talk about our pain or our shame. And one of the interesting features of this story is how many times the woman tries to get the conversation off track and Jesus keeps bringing it back. Very subtly, very lovingly, but he doesn't allow it to go completely off the rails. Now, I don't want to get up and get into the details of this particular debate. Just suffice it to say, when he got personal, she got theological. She brought up a controversial topic to try to get Jesus into a debate. And this can happen to us too. When we move from the superficial to the substantial and we're starting to get to the spiritual, some people are going to say, "I don't want to go there." And they're going to try to get us off track. They might ask questions like, "How can you believe that there's only one way to God?" Or, "If God is so good, how can there be so much pain and suffering?" Or, "How can a loving God send anybody to hell?" And these are questions people will ask, not because they want an answer, but because they want to avoid what you've been talking about. And they think that's going to short circuit the whole conversation. Notice what Jesus does, though. He gently and briefly dealt with her confusion, but he brought it back to the spiritual issue. The problem isn't where you worship, it's how you worship. The problem isn't geographical, it's spiritual. And it gets back to his main subject. And then finally, Jesus secured a connection. Notice in verses 25 in 26. The woman said, "I know that when the Messiah," or the Christ, "comes, He will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I who speak to you am He. The New Living Translation puts it this way. Jesus turned to her and said, I am the Messiah. Now, I really like the NIV. I really like the New Living Translation, but they both missed it on this one. Because there is no He in the Greek. Literally what Jesus said was, I who speak to you, I am. That's it. And we know the significance of I am. She would have known it too. I am is the name of God. That's Yahweh back in the Old Testament. When Moses asked, what is your name? And God said, you tell them I am that I am. Tell them I am sent you. And that's what Jesus said here. He didn't simply say, I am the Messiah. That was what she said. He said, I am. Meaning, I am God. And this is the whole truth. And what Bob said earlier is right. There is not a more clear declaration of who Jesus is than right here. There was another time when, speaking to the Jews, Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. They picked up stones to stone him. It wasn't for poor grammar. They knew exactly what he was saying. You're claiming to be God. To which Jesus said, that's right. What are you going to do about it? He gives her the truth. He secures the connection between the water from the well, the living water, to who Jesus is. And that's where we've got to go. It's great to start a conversation with someone who might not be a believer. It's great to get that commonality, to secure your credibility. You can do all those things, but if you don't get to the connection of their need and Jesus is the answer, we've fallen short. Jesus secured that connection. Now, this beautiful story portrays Jesus as a person who ignored social barriers that were common in his day based on gender and ethnicity and even religion. And you find that the people Jesus often spoke to, the people Jesus often interacted with, were the outcasts. They were the pariahs of society. They were the ones nobody wanted anything to do with. They were the marginalized of their day. We're going to see Jesus talk to those who were sick and people kept their distance. Those who were not Jewish, of a different ethnic background. Those whose lifestyles were rejected by the good folks of the day. Those were the ones Jesus ministered to, and those are the ones who more often than not saw their need and followed Him. The heart of Jesus is filled with love for people who are rejected by others. Jesus came to seek and to save those who are lost. I'm asking you, are we doing that today? Are we intentionally going out and meeting people where they are instead of inviting them to church? I don't know if you've noticed lately, but people aren't busting the doors down to come to church. Have you noticed that? It's not a matter of if you build it, they will come. They ain't coming. First word of the Great Commission is go. Go to where they are. Start a conversation. Find that common ground. Establish your credibility, that you care about them, that they are meaningful to you. And then make that connection with the truth. Bring them to Jesus. I want to ask you again, how many people do you know that don't know Jesus? Let me rephrase that. How many people do you know today that are isolated by their communities or isolated by Christians? How about someone of an ethnic minority in our community? How about a member of the LGBTQ plus community? How about a person that's addicted to alcohol or drugs? Maybe a person with lots of tattoos or piercings. Maybe an atheist who doesn't vote the way you do in November. Are we going to treat them like they've got cooties? Are we going to keep our distance from them, or are we going to go to them and bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to them? Whoever that person might be, they have two things in common with you. They're a person created in the image of God, and they're a person for whom Christ died. And that makes them valuable. That makes them worth your time, your attention, your interest, your compassion. That makes them worth risking your reputation to be seen talking to them, risking the rejection that they might throw in your face. They're worth it. Are we willing? Jesus was. Are we?